Support for the World's podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. To learn about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy, subscribe to the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes and Stitcher.
An immigrant, some popsicles, and a surprise pension. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. An elderly Mexican-American street vendor in Chicago had no plans for retirement. Then a stranger took his picture, posted it online, and it went viral.
I think the picture is the main reason this skyrocketed, because that picture just says pride, it says poverty, it says hard work, it says so many different things.
No wonder donors are pledging money for his retirement. Plus, while our presidential candidates squabble over health, taxes, and transparency, in Brazil, another politician falls to a corruption scandal.
Brazilians would love to have greater transparency from their political class.
Also, the 8-foot-tall Iranian who is changing Paralympic volleyball. That's all coming up today here on The World. Thank you for being with us. So Hillary Clinton's health, Donald Trump's taxes, transparency has suddenly become a big issue in this election. What aren't the candidates telling us? How much should we know about the individuals vying to lead the country? Critical questions as millions of American voters head to the polls in a few weeks' time. In a few minutes, we'll get a French perspective on politicians and transparency. But we want to start you off by asking a different question. What can a single person do to create change? For this story, you need to know that in Mexico, popsicles are called paletas. Stick with me here. And if you've ever visited Chicago in warm weather and wandered down 26th Street, you might have encountered Fidencio Sanchez. The 89-year-old is known there as the Paleta Man. He's been selling popsicles for more than 20 years in his neighborhood called Little Village. A few days ago, Joel Cervantes was driving down 26th Street, where he was born and raised, and he saw Fidencio and his cart. Cervantes snapped a picture. It's quite a photograph. Fidencio's head hangs low over the cart as he struggles to push it down the street. I asked Joel Cervantes what went through his head when he saw Fidencio that day.
I guess you could say sadness. I felt bad for him, but at the same time, I felt really good for him that a man that age still has the will and pride to keep working. But I felt saddened because a person at that age is supposed to be enjoying retirement. And I said, I got to capture this moment of him working and share it to people and show the youth of today that, look, this is what it means to be a hardworking person. And I just wanted people to get out there and see that.
Right. So you bought a few popsicles, gave him a nice tip, and then you kind of told the story on Facebook. What happened then?
So I got a lot of response from the picture, and we were talking on the feed, and some gentleman by the name of Joel O'Hara said, you know, we should start a GoFundMe page. And I go, you know what? That's a great idea. What did I think of that? I made it for $3,000, and within an hour, less than an hour,
wow,
we reached that goal. And that's when I realized that it was something that's huge.
Less than an hour. So how much have you raised so far?
Close to, let me see here, we got $272,000.
Wow, that's fantastic.
I think the picture is the main reason this skyrocketed, because that picture just, it says pride, it says poverty, it says hard work, it says so many different things. It's very powerful.
I gather a lot of the people who contributed shared memories of Fidencio. What kind of things did you learn about him?
Well, that he's been doing it for a while now, but he kind of had slowed down, and his daughter was kind of taking charge of all the bills. His daughter just died recently this year, and he had to pick back up and do the paleta thing again.
Yeah, I mean, I gather that very distressing to have their child die before they did, and I guess that meant they had to work even harder since they didn't.
Yeah, they didn't even have money to bury her. They didn't have money for the funeral costs or anything earlier this year.
So is Fidencio still out on 26th Street selling popsicles, or is he ready to permanently park his paleta cart?
Well, he said he enjoys it. They said he gives him a sense of purpose. So I told him, and he said it's good exercise. I told him, you just buy a treadmill now. you don't have to be walking around and stuff. And but he loves the neighborhood. He loves the people. He loves interacting with everybody. And I guess it keeps him a little sharp. So it's up to him.
Joel, what have you learned over the last few days?
I learned that there is so much good people out there. I mean,
you hear so much negative in the media, everywhere, negative, negative, negative. I mean, you still hear stories here and there, but directly all the people that are inboxing me on Facebook, people all over the world, Germany, you know, we have from Israel, people are saying how beautiful it is, and from Greece, from Singapore, from Australia, from all over the world. It shows you that the world is still a good place. There's more good out there than evil, and unfortunately, we see more evil out on our tubes, on our television, and I think it was just a big reminder. They want to feel part of the goodness, you know, and everybody's coming together, and it's just very beautiful.
Joel Cervantes, you've got a big heart, man. Thanks very much for speaking with us and telling us about Fidencio, the Paleta man, and what you've done for him.
Thank you for your kind words, Marco. Thank you.
Joel's picture of Paleta man Fidencio Sanchez really is moving, a whole life summed up in his posture. You can see it too. Just look for PRI The World on Instagram. Now, as promised, let's turn to a discussion of politics and transparency. Donald Trump's taxes and Hillary Clinton's health have put the issue front and center here in the U.S. But in France, politicians have a long history of keeping their serious illnesses secret. So says Vivian Walt. She writes for Time magazine from her base in Paris. Walt says French President François Mitterrand had cancer for more than a decade in office before voters found out.
He ran for re-election after having been diagnosed with prostate cancer, did not reveal his illness at all. And it was only about 12 years after his diagnosis that this came out in public shortly before he retired from office.
I gather, though, that France is becoming more American when it comes to perceptions of healthy lifestyles.
This is absolutely true. 20 years ago, we had Jacques Chirac in office as president, and he had in 2005, he had a mini stroke. He was rushed to the hospital, was back at work. We're not quite sure how many days later, but there was almost no information given to the French public about what exactly had happened, particularly given that there could have been effects on his brain.
So how does this kind of new desire to know more about politicians affect the French public and their view of who is qualified, on a health level at least, to be their president?
The end of the Chirac era was really the end of an era where you ask no questions about a president's health. Right after that came Nicolas Sarkozy, who was shockingly young by French standards. He was in his early 50s. And he loved to be filmed jogging around. There were very famous videos of him during the campaign, jogging around the parks with his security detail. He was all youth and vigor. He was the new generation. In fact, one famous photo of him showed him jogging up the steps of the Élysée Palace in his shorts and sneakers. And in fact, now he is running for a comeback in next year's election. And once again, he is jogging around the parks of Paris, actually a great contrast to Hollande, who's famously sedentary, never does a stitch of exercise that anybody knows. And in fact, his son recently was in one of the gossip magazines saying that his dad had a treadmill, but he never used it.
Well, you know, I'm wondering if this is not just France, but also kind of Europe-wide, because no one seemed to raise an eyebrow when Theresa May, the new prime minister of the UK, revealed that she had type 1 diabetes.
Absolutely. You know, this was something that was hardly a story as far as I remember. She simply stated it. It was more like, well, sometimes it's a little bit inconvenient. But beyond that, there was never a single question about whether or not this might affect her performance. It just was regarded as being almost kind of tasteless to go down that road of inquiry. And just one other thing about comparing the French presidential elections and the US presidential elections. Under French law, the limit of what presidential candidates can spend is 22.5 million euros. That's about $25 million. So that's really a drop in the bucket in comparison to US presidential campaigns. They last perhaps a few months at best. They are nothing like the kind of 24-hour, 7-day-a-week operation that Trump and Clinton has fielded. And the French look at this campaign that Trump and Clinton have engaged in as a kind of long-running soap opera. It's kind of an astonishing spectacle that unfolds every 4 years.
Our friend Time magazine's Vivian Walt there in Paris. Transparency is also a big issue in Brazil. In fact, the country seems to jump from one corruption scandal to another these days. A little more than a week ago, President Dilma Rousseff was impeached and removed from office. And now the man who brought her down is in hot water himself. Simone Romero is the New York Times Brazil bureau chief. He's in Rio and tells us that Brazilians are fed up.
Brazilians would love to have greater transparency from their political class. And in fairness, even though her administration was plagued by one scandal after another, Dilma Rousseff did sign a groundbreaking transparency law, which required federal institutions to increase their transparency and, you know, the access of normal citizens to the workings of government. But there's been a great deal of resistance to this measure and other similar measures in the country, especially in the federal bureaucracy, in the federal legislature, and especially in the judiciary. It's hard even in Brazil to find out what judges are paid, for instance, even though they get huge salaries in comparison to their counterparts in the United States or in Europe. So it's really one of the demands that many Brazilians have right now. And unfortunately, it's one of those unmet promises that politicians have been making in the country now for some time.
Even now, after all this evidence of corruption?
Even now, that's right. There's a great deal of resistance, among Brazilian politicians about, you know, discussing their own salaries, their own benefits, because they're a source of outrage for many Brazilians. The Congress, members of the Congress, many of them enjoy these lavish lifestyles, separate from all of their accusations of receiving bribery and graft. Their salaries are much higher than what normal Brazilians receive, even in other parts of the federal bureaucracy. So there's a lot of resistance to sort of shedding light on how government really functions in Brazil right now.
Now, the latest scandal in Brazil centers on Eduardo Cunha. Until recently, he was the Speaker of the lower house of Brazil's Congress. Then last night, the House voted almost unanimously to strip him of his seat. I asked Simone Romero what Cunha had done.
Prosecutors who have conducted an in-depth investigation into Eduardo Cunha's finances have found that he had taken bribes in the amount of as much as nearly $40 million and then laundered the proceeds through an evangelical megachurch here in Rio de Janeiro while hiving away millions in secret Swiss accounts.
So now what for him? Could he serve jail time?
You know, that's one possibility. Now that he loses his seat, he also loses the broad legal privileges that federal lawmakers in Brazil enjoy, which nearly always prevent them from going to prison. But it's unclear exactly what will happen. He's signaled in a veiled kind of way that he may try to reach some sort of plea deal with investigators. And that really is sort of sending tremors through Brazil's political establishment.
So tremors in the political class, how far could this go?
It could go very far indeed. You know, we should remember that Eduardo Cunha really was connected to really every major political figure in Brazil's political establishment in recent decades. He was an ally of Dilma Rousseff's government before he broke with them. He was a very close ally of the new president, Michel Temer, in bringing down Dilma Rousseff before he sort of became radioactive to the new administration. So he, you know, presumably may have a lot of dirt on a lot of people in Brasilia right now. And that's really generating a great deal of fear among politicians at the moment.
Simone Romero, the New York Times bureau chief in Brazil, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
You're with the world. What happens to a language once it arrives in the United States? I don't mean a widely spoken language with millions of native speakers in the U.S., like Spanish or Arabic or Mandarin, but one where the numbers are much smaller. Patrick Cox is here. He's co-host of our podcast on languages and the people who speak them, The World in Words. So, Patrick, give us an example of the kind of language we're talking about here.
Sure. Here's one. Vietnamese. This is a language that essentially didn't exist in the United States before the mid-70s and the fall of Saigon, end of the Vietnam War, after which there was a huge wave of refugees in the late 70s and 80s. Many of these Vietnamese refugees settled in Southern California, Orange County, especially where there is a little Saigon. Mm. And that was where Lily Bui was born to Vietnamese refugee parents. She was raised in something of a Vietnamese bubble. It was her first language. Today, she's a PhD student at MIT, and she only actually re-enters that Vietnamese bubble when she goes home to Orange County to visit her family. Here she is in the podcast talking about a typical visit, hanging out at home, just Lily and her mom.
We're both in our pajamas, and she's usually flipping through a Vietnamese magazine or scrolling through videos on her iPad. You can always smell her cooking downstairs, no matter what the time of day or night it is. Sometimes we sit in complete silence for minutes at a time. Sometimes we tell stories. Sometimes, without even thinking about it, she'll start singing. The song she's singing is called Ao Ơi Ao. It's a lullaby. My grandma sang it to her, and my mom sang it to me when I was little. She tells me the song is about a bridge in the country made out of wood. The bridge is hard to walk over, but the mother, who's singing, says that she'll walk with her child.
My name is Mai Bui, and I'm just a mother of the two children.
Just a mother? Here is a woman who runs her own accounting business, organizes events for her community, and worked as a music teacher in Vietnam and in the U.S. But still, when I ask her to introduce herself, she calls herself simply a mother.
Yeah, simply a mother who happens to have a really nice voice, Patrick. How do younger Vietnamese Americans keep up their Vietnamese skills? I mean, it's not like you come across the language all that much here in the States.
Yeah. Lily and I, we talked about this. This is what she said.
A lot of learning of Vietnamese happens inside the home. But there are more and more opportunities to learn it in formal ways. And I think, in general, the Vietnamese community is realizing that there's this need to carry it on beyond the family itself. So I spoke to a professor at UCLA who makes this his main mission. His name is Thay Quynh Nhi. And he has this really interesting way of teaching the language. He says that teaching Vietnamese makes him a dancer. So he uses these really kinetic analogies to teach students to use accent marks. So you would think that a normal language class is just sitting in a classroom and reading things on a board or in a book. And with Vietnamese, there are a lot of accent marks. And he likes to spice things up a little bit. And accent marks in Vietnamese, there are some that go up, some that go down, and then some that dip down and then come back up. And he finds ways to teach students how to write accent marks by actually having them act out the accent marks. He has them stand up and dance the tonal inflections by moving their bodies and gesturing with their hands.
Everybody laugh. But after that, they remember. Mm-hmm. They remember.
I found another person, Billy Lay, who's with the Garden Grove Unified School District, also in Orange County, which serves one of the biggest Vietnamese populations outside of Vietnam. And he helped set up a dual language immersion program.
I feel that it's important for us to keep that culture and language in us by teaching our kids, because if we don't, how do we learn from our past mistakes or anything from the history to better ourselves?
Okay, it sounds as though the Vietnamese language is incredibly important to Vietnamese people.
Mm-hmm.
But really? I mean, like, would your cultural identity vanish without the language and your mother's?
There is an assumption that language and culture come together and are this inseparable thing, but maybe not. So when I talked to my mom, she told me about a little piece of culture that doesn't necessarily have to do with the language at all. And this is her áo dài, her traditional Vietnamese dress. So if you can imagine, it's a long, flowy gown, usually in soft, bright colors, sometimes with patterns. It's got a very high collar, and you wear it with silk pants. And this is something that she tends to dress up in a lot when she goes to events and weddings and things like that.
In college, we have International Day, and I wear my áo dài to that event, and everybody just look at me and they say, "Oh, it's so beautiful," and they come to me and they look at my áo dài, and it's made me very proud and very happy.
But then again, she's convinced that the language is central to her identity.
you have to speak your language in order to understand your culture. We have a proverb, uống nước nhớ nguồn. That means when you drink the water, you have to remember the source. Whenever you go, whoever you are, you still have to remember where you come from. I always remember what I am, and I'm a Vietnamese girl.
So, Patrick, the mom is still that Vietnamese girl, born in Vietnam, but what about her daughter, Lily, born here in the United States?
Yeah, it's much more complicated for her. She's an American as well as somewhat Vietnamese. And here's a great example of just where she is, just on that knife edge. I asked her whether she'd be passing the Vietnamese language on to her children, if and when, and she's on the fence about this. Huh. It was a no-brainer for her mom to pass Vietnamese on to her. But Lily, at high school, at college, she studied Spanish, and she's fluent in Spanish, so she's thinking she might pass that on instead.
Yeah, so what does her mom think about that, this could be the last stop for the family's ancestral language?
Well, this is the way that Lily thinks about it. She's long had this obsession with Cuba, Spanish-speaking, of course, and she's talked to her mom about this, about how the two countries, Cuba and Vietnam, they have a whole load in common. Both of them, you can think of them almost as victims of the Cold War. There were communist takeovers, American sympathy for the opponents of the communists, who were the losers. They became refugees. They had to leave, came to the United States. And so there's all of these parallel storylines. And Lily thinks that in a funny way, that is why she connected with the Spanish language. And once she got that, she could explain it to her mom. And seemingly her mom now accepts that to this American-born daughter, there's this much more widely spoken language, Spanish, whose speakers, some of them at least, have this shared experience with Vietnamese refugees.
Well, fascinating. Acceptance through triangulation with another country. Patrick Cox is with our podcast, The World in Words. You can check it out at iTunes or at pri.org/language. Patrick, thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Marco.
You're tuned to The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. Ultimate Frisbee. It seems to be pretty laid back, but what if it became an Olympic sport?
Getting to the Olympics is necessarily going to mean a little bit more competitiveness and a little bit more kind of cutthroat attitude.
The push to make Ultimate Frisbee the first mixed-gender Olympic sport, that's coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. I don't know about you, but I have been really into the Paralympics. I was glued to the U.S. versus Great Britain basketball game last night. Incredible skills. And I hear there was an exciting sitting volleyball match the other night between Iran and China. Iran has a player you can't miss, literally. Ben Spiegel is in Rio reporting on the Paralympics for the New York Times. He says sitting volleyball is pretty much what it sounds like.
It's awesome. It's faster than regular volleyball. So
really?
It'd be like this. Yeah, because, you know, it's a smaller court. And with a smaller court, it's a lower net. And so the points go a little bit faster. There's sort of a whole range of disabilities. And so each team can go ahead and carry two players who are deemed as minimally disabled. If you have a chronic knee injury that is preventing you from playing stand-up volleyball, you might be eligible to play sitting down. And there are people who might have problems with their arms but have full function of their legs, or you have people who don't have any legs. It really is a whole range of impairments. And so you slide around on this court, and it's the same as volleyball. You go ahead and pass it around and try to score points. But unlike in stand-up volleyball, the other team can block the serve. If you've never seen that happen before, especially when you're trying to serve over someone who is 8'1" standing up and 6'4" sitting down, it is quite a sight to see.
All right, you said 8'1", and I'm inclined to not believe that, but I do know that the Iranian team has this guy, Morteza Merizad, more than 8 feet tall. Tell us about him.
I was doing some reporting before the games, trying to get a feel for a lot of different sports that I'd be seeing down here. And one of the American coaches just mentioned, yeah, you know, there's so many tall players now. Brazil has a couple guys who are 6'7", 6'8", 6'10". And then there's a guy on Iran who's 8'1". I'm just like, no, you've got to be kidding me. This is some sort of lie. And then I get down here, and there he is.
Measures up.
He's,
huh?
Yeah, he's massive. But he also, because of his condition, he has a leg that is about 6 inches shorter than another one. So he really can't walk a whole lot, or he needs crutches. And so when you saw the Iranian team line up for introductions, national anthem, and that sort of thing before the match, he was standing up for a part of it, but there are others in which he was sitting down. And so at that moment, you really couldn't get a feel for exactly how big he was until he did stand up later, and you're like, oh my God, this guy is enormous.
Is his disability the fact that he is 8 feet tall, essentially?
Well, it's not the disability. It's that one leg is 6 inches right. shorter than the other. He had an overactive pituitary gland, from what I understood, and always kind of been very tall. But he had a bike accident at age 16 in which he had the leg problems that resulted from it.
So you saw Morteza Merizad play on Saturday. How'd he do?
I did. You know, it's funny because he didn't start. And so the first set goes by and he's still on the bench. And then the second set starts and he's still on the bench. And then finally he comes in and the first point, he's stationed on the outside right by the net. And you can just see the players on the Chinese front line, like they're adjusting their entire strategy. And you can see how he alters the game just by his presence. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have to go ahead and hit the ball. Just by his being there, you're forcing the Chinese players to hit over him because they're afraid he's going to block it. And on the first point, he's at the net, has both arms up, and there's kind of a tip, kind of, you know, a floater that sailed wide because of him. And
yeah.
Then he had another spike in which he goes just straight down. It's almost as if you're swinging a sledgehammer from the top and you just go straight down.
Yep.
And just sort of what the action looks like. It's unlike anything I've ever seen before.
Yeah, he does sound like a ringer. So you spoke with Iran's volleyball coach, sitting volleyball coach, Hadi Rezaei. How did he discover Merizad?
There's a program in Iran, apparently, in which people with physical abnormalities or unusual talents, that sort of thing, I guess it's maybe like the Iranian equivalent of Ripley's Believe It or Not or something, and they featured him. And being the resourceful and enterprising coach that he is, he was like, hey, I could use this guy. And so he reached out to the network, who was able to go ahead and connect him. And he went ahead and told Morteza that he would like to train him to be a volleyball player. He said he would like to improve the quality of his life. He would like to make him a champion. And Morteza agreed. And 5 years later, this is his second international competition, and his coach thinks that he's already, you know, could be the best player in the world and haven't even come close to maximizing his potential.
I gather Iran has always been pretty good at sitting volleyball. Are they grooming players in a way that other countries are not?
I don't know, but it wasn't as if they, as you mentioned, had this sort of dearth of talent and they're looking for the savior. They've won, I believe it's 5 golds and 2 silvers in the last 7 Paralympics. Mm. They've either beaten or lost to, I think, Bosnia during that time. And they just drilled Bosnia, I think it was last night. And so Iran is certainly the team to beat here at these games. But when you have a guy who's 8'1" and you want to go ahead and bring him onto your team in a sport in which height is a pretty coveted attribute, then you do what you can to convince him to play for you.
Ben Spiegel, reporting on the Paralympics in Rio for the New York Times. Thank you very much.
Hey, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Kind of makes you wonder why the TV networks aren't showing more of those Paralympic events. After all, NBC and the rest are always looking for the next big thing in sports. So is the International Olympic Committee, and one way they boost interest in the games is by adding new events. Here's one possibility: Ultimate Frisbee. One selling point there, men and women play on the same team. But as the world's Jason Margolis tells us, ultimate athletes themselves have mixed emotions about going for gold.
With all due respect, when I think of Frisbee, I don't think of the world's finest athletes. I'm not alone.
People think of ultimate as, you know, a bunch of guys running around, smoking weed, hanging out with dogs. You know, it is, in fact, a very competitive and athletic sport, and we like to showcase that.
Alex Trahey is co-captain of Boston's Slow White, the second-ranked mixed ultimate frisbee team in the nation.
One, two, three! Slow White!
The other captain is Hannah Baranis. They're serious athletes, but both say that image of frisbee being a laid-back beach and barbecue game, That's right, too. And that's a good thing.
One thing that's really cool about Ultimate is that people like get familiarity with like throwing a Frisbee as a fun thing. And then when they discover that there's this sport attached to it, the more likely you are to get a person to be active and get them involved in playing down the road.
Okay, quick timeout for the uninitiated. Ultimate is kind of like soccer meets football, but with a Frisbee. It's a quick study. I went to a tournament in Devens, Massachusetts, and picked up the basics pretty easily. Players sprint, dive, and time leaps to snatch a spinning Frisbee slowly floating back down to Earth. High-octane, impressive stuff. In slow-mo, this is going to look amazing at the Olympics, if it gets there. Kirsten Lundquist, who plays mixed-gender ultimate for Boston Slow White, hopes it will.
I think women's sports has made tremendous strides, but it's still very inequitable, I think, across the globe. So anything to promote women in sport, and I think a mixed-gender athletic event is really great because it really emphasizes the parity between men and women because they're sharing the same field.
I asked co-captain Hannah Baranis if she's excited her sport is being considered for the 2024 Olympics.
My instinct says yes, but...
She hesitates because she hears a lot of arguments against Olympic inclusion. Co-captain Alex Trahey shares her ambivalence.
Getting to the Olympics is necessarily going to mean a little bit more competitiveness and a little bit more kind of cutthroat attitude. I think if we do it right and we showcase what's good about Ultimate, that we emphasize this fair play and respect and spirit of the game, then yes. I think if we sacrifice our values to get there, it's not worth it.
One value is inclusion. Many worry that mixed teams going for gold might heavily favor the men on the field and effectively ignore their female players. Another value of the sport is self-officiating.
Travel call! Travel call! Hey, there's a call! Travel call!
As I watched, I saw a few fouls get called. Nobody put up a fuss. But if a gold medal is on the line, you think they're going to let the players have that much power? Marshall Goff, the coach of Slow White, is concerned about the Olympics changing the way the game is officiated.
The more pressure there is, the more visibility, the more outside influence, how does it play on TV, how fast does it move, all of those things are hard to predict as they ramp up.
Ultimate prides itself on being laid back, even at the top levels. With a trip to the national championships on the line, teams at the regional finals in Massachusetts dance around and act silly during warm-ups. Tom Crawford, the CEO of USA Ultimate, believes the game can maintain its countercultural appeal and become a more serious sport. He came to Ultimate from the mainstream after front office stints in professional football, hockey, and basketball.
Because of all the different roles I've had in sport, I've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly. I really believe in the power of sport to enhance human existence. And so when I saw Ultimate, it was like, man, everything is baked into this sport that I love about sport. Let's grow this sport so more people discover it like I just did.
And what better way to do that than securing a spot on the world's biggest stage? But will Olympic inclusion get more kids playing at the youth level?
Well, that's a good question.
David Goldblatt is author of the new book, The Games, A Global History of the Olympics. He says linking participation rates to Olympic inclusion, it's complicated.
Because, you know, what determines global levels of participation in a sport, if one could measure such a thing, is often dependent on quite a lot more than whether it was on the Olympics or not.
The International Olympic Committee has a somewhat opaque process for how a new event gets included in the Games. The sport has to promote gender equality, appeal to youth, be played in many countries.
I mean, eyeballs, that seems to me is the number one issue. It's just about eyeballs.
Go catch!
And for those purists who think Ultimate Frisbee doesn't deserve a spot at the Summer Olympics, get used to the counterculture coming. Skateboarding and surfing will be at the next Summer Games in Tokyo. For The World, Jason Margolis, Devens, Massachusetts.
In Mexico, same-sex marriage is a hot-button issue. Across the country, there have been big demonstrations both for and against it in recent days, and there are more marches planned for later this month. Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto wants to legalize gay marriage nationwide, but that seems to have sparked a political backlash, says Lester Fader, who covers LGBT issues for BuzzFeed.
The court case that sort of led to this moment actually happened in late 2012. At that point, there was a Supreme Court ruling that said that all state laws that prohibited same-sex marriage were unconstitutional. But because of technicalities in Mexico's legal system, the court didn't have the power to just wipe them away. So there's been this process of litigation in the years since that now has allowed same-sex couples to marry in most states and allows couples, any couple, just to go to a registrar now in 10 of those states. The situation, though, was that this was happening so slowly and so gradually that it didn't attract widespread attention in Mexico until the president came out and saying that he wanted a constitutional amendment to try to advance this process without people having to bring a lot more litigation in the remaining states.
Well, so up to this point where President Peña Nieto announced he wanted to do this, it had been happening, but you're saying people didn't really notice?
Yeah, I mean, legally, the question is basically settled. The Supreme Court of Mexico has ruled that same-sex couples have a right to marry. But there's an implementation problem, and that is what has brought this now to a broader conflict.
So when you look at these demonstrations and counter-demonstrations in the cities of Mexico, what are people demonstrating about?
You know, the immediate thing that brought people to the street was opposition to this proposed constitutional amendment from the president. His approval ratings at this point are extremely low. They were low. I think they were in the 30s back when he proposed this in the spring. I think they're now in the low 20s following his meeting with Donald Trump. And so he wasn't really in a place to press this agenda. It had been sort of percolating along without any conflict, and most of the legal experts I've spoken with were confident eventually that would bring same-sex marriage to every Mexican state. But since he threw his weight behind it, it sort of turned this into a national conflict and sort of prompted these demonstrations in response.
But do LGBT activists in Mexico want Peña Nieto to not have same-sex marriage legalization for Mexico on his agenda?
I think it's a complicated issue. On the one hand, there were many who were very excited that they had gotten that level of endorsement back in the spring. Mexico's never really had a national LGBT movement, and though it has, there are certain very significant legal gains, including a prohibition on sexual orientation discrimination in the Constitution, it never had that kind of institutional base. That was a blessing at first. I'm not sure anybody foresaw, one, that he would remain so politically weak for so long, or that the opposition would get so organized, because there never had been an organized opposition really either.
Mm. So Mexico is also a majority Catholic country. Where do Catholic leaders in Mexico stand on all of this?
Well, Catholic leaders, as in most of the rest of the world, have been firmly opposed to this. But the fact that the country is Catholic doesn't mean that it's going to be less likely to embrace marriage equality. The issue is about the different political cultures and the power of the church. Mexico has a long history of curtailing church activities and politics, including for a long time prohibiting priests from voting. So the question here is whether the church will have the political clout to endorse these marches and help stop the marriage amendment.
Lester Fader with BuzzFeed. Thank you, as always.
Yep, my pleasure.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's time for a story about a truly historic shift to the right in Sweden. Not to worry, we're not talking about politics. Ashley Byrne with the BBC's Witness program takes us back almost five decades.
The day after a revolution.
On the 3rd of September 1967, motorists, cyclists and pedestrians across Sweden had to relearn how to navigate the road system as the entire country, in unison, switched over to a right-hand drive system and what had become known as Dagenhor.
Every major road junction, every halt sign, every roundabout has had to be changed, ready for the moment when the traffic does its about turn.
Dagenhor, or H-Day, referring to the Swedish word höger, meaning right, had been a monumental task, 4 years in the execution and meticulously planned. Bjorn Sylvain was a young boy growing up in Stockholm in 1967. He remembers the mood of his friends and family.
They were frightened that there should be lots of accidents and so on, so they were very worried.
In Stockholm alone, 180 new sets of lights have been installed alongside the old ones.
The decision to switch to driving on the right-hand side had been discussed in 1927. The idea had not been popular, but refused to go away. In 1955, a referendum was called, and 83% of the public in Sweden voted to remain driving on the left, despite this being different to the majority of Europe, and especially neighbouring countries Norway, Finland and Denmark.
There are 8 million people in Sweden, and 2 million of them have a car.
The Swedish government continued to push for the change, in part because the majority of the cars already on Swedish roads at the time weren't actually designed for them.
In a country that drives on the left, oddly enough, the steering wheel in the car is also on the left.
And that was no good in left-hand traffic, of course. I was very worried that we were going to crash.
In 1963, the State Right-Hand Drive Commission was created and work began to switch the entire road network around. The move was still unpopular, though, and so a national promotion campaign began. Swedish television even ran a song competition to raise public awareness.
I hold the till hörde Svensson. I hold the till hörde Anna slutade. Bara med en smäll.
Till höger, Svensson, pom, pom. Well, I remember it quite well. It was on the radio all the time. Keep to the right, Svensson. Håll dig till höger, Svensson. Annars slutar det bara med en smäll. All it ended at in a crash.
Håll dig till höger, Svensson. Håll dig till höger, annars slutar det bara med en smäll.
As H Day approached, it was clear that the change would be much harder in Sweden's biggest cities. For most of the country, all non-essential traffic would be banned from 1 a.m. until 6 p.m. on Sunday the 3rd of September to allow work crews to carry out the switchover of signs and traffic control. So after 40 years of discussion and resistance and 4 years of major planning and construction, H Day had finally arrived. And any vehicle still on the road ground to a halt at precisely 4:50 a.m. in the morning.
I have to stop for a while here. I shall then be shown on to the other side of the road. I then have to stop there. And at 5 o'clock, we all move off, driving on the right-hand side of the road.
And then in the radio, they said, now it's 5 o'clock and Sweden has right-hand traffic. And then they were home to drive.
But even with such careful preparation, there was bound to be a hiccup or two.
On the first day, there was older people that still drived on the left-hand side. And, of course, there was a very dangerous meeting in the corner.
In the end, there were only 157 minor accidents reported on H Day.
Next year, in 1968, the number of deaths in the traffic in Sweden had fallen a lot.
Sweden's big switch showed the rest of the world how it could be done. A year later, Iceland followed suit, and a few years after that, the former British colonies of Nigeria and Ghana also made the transition.
Ashley Byrne reporting there for our still left-lane driving colleagues at the BBC. Finally today, another transportation story that might make you feel nostalgic. If you've ever traveled by train, then you've probably seen and heard the Solari board. That's the arrivals and departures board with letters and numbers that flip. You know what I'm talking about. Large Italian-made analog signs that just feel like old Europe. And fewer of them are in use. Right here in the States, Amtrak officials are planning to replace the Solari board in Philadelphia's 30th Street station with a digital one. Matt Sohr prefers the analog version. He's an associate professor of communication studies at Concordia University in Montreal. But what he really likes to do is collect and restore old Solari boards.
At the age of about 9 or 10, a good weekend for me was going with a friend with some cheese and onion sandwiches and a thermos flask of hot chocolate and spending a day at some of the terminus stations in London, such as St. Pancras and King's Cross and Euston and Paddington, collecting the numbers of the engines as they came into those terminus stations. What I remember now, which I didn't really appreciate at the time, was that in each of those stations, there were these jumbo displays of cascading letters and numbers that had this kind of waterfall effect to them as you looked at them from top to bottom, but also had this amazing, very, very distinctive fluttering sound to them as the information changed on them. Which must have been a comfort to a lot of people looking for information to understand where they needed to be and for which train, but for me, was all part of the mix of being in a huge old station with an vaulted ceiling and the smell of diesel fumes. If I think about my research, if I look back at the kinds of things I've been interested in, I'm often interested in new technologies, but I'm also interested in older technologies, residual technologies that have been and gone in recent memory. And I've found that they're not all the same. They don't have all the same kinds of characteristics. So these Solaris, I demonstrate these Solaris split flaps to anybody who's interested. And I often get a smile or a warm nod of acknowledgement with this sound that for a lot of us is very, very familiar and takes us a long way back in our own lives and our own experiences of travel. But it's not like, for instance, the squawk of a modem, an old dial-up modem, or the chugging away of a fax machine, which I think maybe nobody misses all that much. So some of these residual technologies continue to resonate for us, and some of them really don't.
That was Matt Sohr of Concordia University in Montreal. You know, just hearing that sound makes me want to hop a train. I'm not the only one. A lot of us here in the newsroom are feeling nostalgic for the Solari board and great train trips we've taken. Tell us about yours and your memories of Solari boards. Just look for The World on Facebook. And as much as I'd like to hop a train, this is our last stop today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you all tomorrow.
PRI. Public Radio International.